Today is Thursday, July 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Australia's second most populated city began its second lockdown.
Melbourne's 5 million residents went back under strict lockdown rules on Thursday, with everyone but essential workers told to stay home for the next 6 weeks.
Plus, how those on the remote Navajo Nation are dealing with the pandemic.
We try to provide 2 weeks' worth of food for the entire household.
And the Supreme Court says that President Trump has to release his financial records. We'll have those stories and more next. Not long ago, the United States Supreme Court issued their final opinions of its current term, with attention focused on three high-profile cases involving requests for President Donald Trump's tax record and other financial documents by congressional committees and a New York prosecutor. To break down the court's decisions, I spoke with Michael Moreland, law professor at Villanova University in Pennsylvania.
Well, the first case, Vance, is a New York grand jury prosecution case where the district attorney asked for financial records from the president and the Trump organization. And then the second was a case involving congressional subpoenas from House committees that were asking for presidential documents and records pursuant to their legislative purpose.
Now, both of these decisions came out 7-2, with both Trump appointees, Kavanaugh and Gorsuch, siding with the majority. And since we have two decisions, let's take them one at a time. So we'll start with Vance, the New York prosecutory office decision.
Well, the president and the Department of Justice had argued that there is effectively an absolute immunity for the president from state criminal prosecutorial proceedings. And that's the view that the court rejected, that there's no absolute immunity for the president. And so given that, the subpoenas can go forward. Now, the court or the Supreme Court did remand the case back to the district court for enforcement. Well, as to specific provisions, the president can still make arguments about interference with his constitutional duties because the states can't effectively prosecute presidents for anything they're doing as part of their official duties. And so he can keep making those kinds of arguments in the New York case.
As I understand the Vance case, these are for tax records that took place before he took office. So would that even be a valid argument?
Well, there'll be arguments that, that it's a fishing expedition, the kind of arguments that defendants often make in these kinds of settings.
And the second case, the Mazur's case, that was also sent back down to lower courts.
That's right. The Supreme Court said that both sides, that is to say the House of Representatives and the president, had advanced views that were too extreme in each respect. And so there needs to be more of a balancing consideration involving the separation of powers for the enforcement of the House of Representatives subpoena. So there again, the cases will be remanded.
Taking a look at these two discussions and two decisions that came out, what does this really say for the checks and balances and the balances of powers between the judiciary, the legislative branch, and the executive branch?
Well, I think in both cases, Chief Justice Roberts was very careful and clever in keeping the Supreme Court out of the story as much as possible. That is to say, sending the cases back, not getting overly involved during an electoral season, and sending the cases back to the lower courts. And in the congressional subpoena case, as to separation of powers, but your question, I do think that the court wants the political branches, that is, say, the president and Congress, to work it out and not to have to come to the Supreme Court.
Michael Moreland teaches at Villanova University, where he is the director of the Eleanor H. McCullen Center for Law, Religion, and Public Policy. The World Health Organization will set up an independent panel to review its handling of the COVID-19 pandemic and the response by governments. The announcement follows strong criticism by U.S. President Donald Trump's administration, which accuses the WHO of being China-centric, and formal notification on Tuesday that the U.S. is withdrawing from the UN agency in a year. The novel coronavirus pandemic has reached a new milestone with more than 12 million confirmed infections, according to the online tracker created by Johns Hopkins University near Washington. A new study published on Wednesday in the scientific journal Nature has found that older people, men, racial and ethnic minorities, and those with pre-existing health conditions such as obesity, diabetes, and severe asthma are more likely to die from COVID-19. The researchers also found that roughly 11% of the total number of patients tracked in the survey identified as non-white, and that these patients, particularly Black and South Asians, were at higher risk of dying from the coronavirus than white patients. Australia's second most populous city began a six-week lockdown Thursday following a spike in new coronavirus cases, as states around the country tightened internal borders to prevent a second wave from sweeping around the country. Reuters' Libby Hogan has more.
Melbourne's 5 million residents went back under strict lockdown rules on Thursday, with everyone but essential workers told to stay home for the next 6 weeks. Bar manager Leanne House said she was preparing her business for the new measures.
We are pretty lucky that we don't have to do too many changes. So we've always been able to do takeaways, and now we'll just continue to do takeaways, but it'll be our sole trade.
Victoria on Thursday reported 165 new infections in the last 24 hours, an increase on the previous day's 134. It follows the border closure with New South Wales, where Sydney is located, on Wednesday to try and contain the outbreak. Meanwhile, other states and territories have reported zero cases in recent weeks and are reopening their economies. Australia has so far escaped a high number of casualties from the new coronavirus, with just under 8,900 infections.
Libby Hogan reports for Reuters News. In the United States, more than 3 million people have contracted the coronavirus, and more than 130,000 people have died. Now, there has been a dramatic surge of cases in some of the country's biggest states, including California, Florida, Texas, and Arizona. VOA's Mariama Diallo takes things from here.
The California coronavirus surge, led by Governor Gavin Newsom, a Democrat, to order partial lockdowns in about a third of the state's 58 counties. The state assembly, scheduled to return from summer recess next week, is also closed indefinitely. That's unacceptable to some Republicans.
It's just not a sustainable solution to shut the legislative branch of government down indefinitely. There are people across the state who depend on the work we do, not least of which the work that is directly relevant to addressing the public health issues related to COVID-19 and the associated issues affecting the economy and people's lives.
In Florida, another hard-hit state, Republican Governor Ron DeSantis says there are medical facilities across the state ready to handle the influx of coronavirus cases.
In South Florida, you now have the Miami Care Center. You have a facility in Broward that's COVID only. And then you have two in Palm Beach County that are COVID only. So that's a pretty significant number of beds to be able to care for people who are COVID positive.
On Tuesday, Florida Democratic congressional delegation blasted the governor's response to the outbreak, saying his refusal to issue statewide orders requiring masks and closing beaches is killing Floridians and spreading the disease. Florida has been averaging more than 8,500 new confirmed cases per day during the past week, almost eight times the average of a month ago. In Arizona, there's also a record demand for hospital beds.
We are definitely not seeing the curve bend. I mean, every day it seems one after another, there's a new record level of brand new cases of COVID-19 in the state of Arizona.
Texas, during a surge, has become one of the U.S. states worst hit by the coronavirus pandemic. More than 10,000 new cases on Tuesday, a record since the pandemic started. But despite state orders, many locals, such as these rodeo spectators, still reject social distancing regulations and wearing face masks.
Because I'm an American and I feel like I should be able to do what I want to, I pay my taxes, I live free, I want to be free.
Because it's against our constitutional rights. They shouldn't be able to dictate what I wear.
But a leading American infectious diseases expert warns after the past weekend's Independence Day celebrations, the number of coronavirus cases could increase dramatically.
We are in one of the worst parts of the epidemic. This is the beginning. They will double in the next 2 weeks and then double again the week after that.
But the White House COVID-19 task force sees a different picture.
We're actually seeing early indications of a percent of positive testing flattening in Arizona and Florida and Texas. Governors in each of those states have taken strong steps to flatten the curve.
Vice President Mike Pence's comments come as the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention readies to issue new guidance for reopening of schools in the fall. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
And still to come in today's program.
We try to provide 2 weeks' worth of food for the entire household. 2 weeks is long enough for a family to sort of start experiencing symptoms if they've been exposed to COVID-19. And if they have, seek the help that they need to isolate from the larger community to prevent community spread.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Researchers say they found evidence of contact between Polynesian and Native people from what is now Colombia, centuries before Europeans arrived in South America. Using deep genetic analysis, researchers at California's Stanford University School of Medicine, the National Laboratory of Genomics for Biodiversity in Mexico, and their international team of colleagues found signs of a common ancestry between the two groups of people. The analysis was based on genetic material gathered from more than 800 indigenous people of French Polynesia and Colombia. The researchers say their extensive analysis provided common genetic signatures comprising of both Polynesian and Native American DNA that go back hundreds of years. The research indicates that the two groups of people met around the year 1200 and produced children who had both Native American and Polynesian DNA. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Lebanon is drifting deeper into crisis as it struggles to halt its collapsing currency and wider financial meltdown, raising big concerns for its stability. Hopes of salvation through an IMF deal have retreated, with the government either unwilling or unable to enact reforms. Nearby Gulf countries are reluctant to help because the most powerful actor in Lebanon is Iranian-backed Hezbollah. VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi spoke with Joe McCarron, a research fellow at the Arab Center in Washington, about the deepening crisis.
There are some structural problems in Lebanon that prevent the needed reform. Obviously, lack of willingness from the political class. Many of those reforms basically weaken their grip over the country. Second, there's no real financial support from outside. So before I think we start the economic reform, there's need to start with some political reform. Basically, an election is crucial now to reinvent the political class. And this will allow maybe to have more public support for such a move. But I think the main issue is the lack of willingness to reform, the external interventions in Lebanon, and the inability also of the protesters to voice their demands into a very clear political demand. Also, it means the alternative political class is not ready to emerge. And this bit might be one of the most challenges facing Lebanon.
If the IMF loan stumbles and the Gulf countries are reluctant to help because the most powerful actor in Lebanon is the Iranian-backed Hezbollah, how would Lebanon get out of this economic collapse?
I mean, there's no way out in the immediate future. As you said, with the Gulf not giving money as they used to be in the last decades, and with the U.S.-Iranian confrontation, which has been increased a lot in recent weeks, we don't see this government ready to offer political reform. And the external factors are not helping. We see Iranians addressing their own agenda. And we see the U.S. trying to make all the reforms in Lebanon about the fighting between Iran and the U.S. The fact is, both Washington and Tehran are not willing to basically change the course in some sense. And Hezbollah also wants to keep this political environment that's protecting its influence, its weapons in the Lebanese politics. And they are not interested in letting go those corrupt politicians in the process. So we are in a vicious circle somehow now, until we see maybe a larger popular anger against the political class. It might grow more in the coming weeks and months. The poverty rate is increasing, the lack of money, lack of opportunities. So we might see more anger growing. But the greatest challenge is there's no viable alternative for this political class.
Would Europe lend a helping hand to avoid that prospect of another Arab state collapsing at its doorstep and new influx of refugees arriving on its southern shores?
We are not at the stage yet that Lebanon will be on the verge of full collapse, even if it's going in this direction. And the problem is Europe also have its own challenges. It's recovering from the coronavirus outbreak. So if the Gulf don't have free cash to give, also Europeans are in the same boat. And they are expecting Lebanon to enact some real reform so they can free some money from the IMF and other parties. And till now, there's no clear vision from the Lebanese government to advance this. And we have seen in the resignation of key members of the Lebanese team with the IMF. So unless we see a real readiness from the government, basically to reform the banking sector and reduce their influence on the Lebanese economy, I mean, the international community need to see some movement in direction of reform. And so far, this government is worried more about survival, but they need to move forward if they need to have avoiding a clear collapse of the Lebanese state.
Joe McCarron is a research fellow at the Arab Center, and he was speaking to VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi. South Korea's Yonhap News Agency reports that Seoul City Mayor Park Won-soon has been found dead. Police have been looking for the mayor after he left a message that his daughter described as sounding like a will. The Seoul Metropolitan Police Agency found his body at Mount Bugak in northern Seoul, near where his cell phone signal was last detected during a late-night search. An activist and a human rights lawyer, Park became the city's first mayor to be voted into a third term last June. He was also a potential presidential candidate in the 2022 elections. China's top diplomat on Thursday warned the United States against McCarthy-style paranoia as tensions rise between the two powers. Beijing and Washington have been sparring over a slew of issues, from a new national security law in Hong Kong to trade and U.S. criticism of China's handling of the coronavirus pandemic. In addition, China slammed an Australian decision on Thursday to offer safe haven to thousands of Hong Kong citizens and suspend an extradition pact with the city as gross interference in its affairs. Worldwide, the United States has the largest number of COVID-19 infections by far. And some U.S. Native American communities that were already isolated and impoverished have been hit especially hard. On the Navajo and Hopi reservations in the American Southwest, there are only 12 health facilities for nearly 200,000 people. And when the pandemic hit, they had only two ventilators between them. There is also a shortage of food stores on Navajo land, which forced many to travel far to get supplies for their families. Originally, no federal relief funds were earmarked for Native American reservations, and when there were, it took a month for the money to be released. In response, several Navajo and Hopi women formed a group to deliver food and supplies to the most vulnerable and organize the sewing of face masks. And to find out more, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Navajo attorney and activist Ethel Branch via Zoom, who founded the Navajo and Hopi Families COVID-19 Relief Fund.
We really did want to be focused on families and making sure that the vulnerable people in our communities were protected, like our elders, our children, and the many people who have underlying medical conditions, trying to make sure that our people still had access to food, even though we anticipated there would be interruptions in the supply chain. And it's been really incredible. I mean, everyone comes with really great intentions, and we're not worried about who's going to get credit for what. It's just about, let's get this job done. And that's why we were able to scale up so quickly, where we're bringing $100,000 worth of food to our communities each week, serving 1,000 households a week.
So the primary objective is delivering food to Navajo and Hopi people.
Really, our objective is to make sure that people stay home to avoid community spread. We try to provide 2 weeks worth of food for the entire household. 2 weeks is long enough for a family to sort of start experiencing symptoms if they've been exposed to COVID-19. And if they have, seek the help that they need to isolate from the larger community to prevent community spread. And also providing baby diapers, baby formula, adult diapers, things that might draw people out of the home into the larger community where they risk exposure to COVID-19.
Are you pleased with how it's been going?
It's been working pretty well, considering in most instances, we don't have fixed distribution sites. We have team leaders that will step forward in local communities and offer to do a food distribution. And then we'll provide them the names of the people who've reached out to us from those communities requesting help. And they will assemble a team of volunteers. The team leader also identifies a distribution site. And those can be really difficult because there really aren't many business locations on the reservation. You really have the chapter government or schools. And aside from that, like you might have a gas station. So we've had to be very adaptive, very problem-solving focused in each of these contexts. And then we've had just really great leadership at the local level to find solutions where we might think that they don't exist. For me personally, if I were not able to do this work, it would just be so depressing to look at what's happening.
This isn't just charity on the part of your volunteers. It's really personal.
Definitely. I think probably all of our volunteers have been touched by this in some way, either, you know, the family member getting sick or someone in their family passing. And it can be very overwhelming. I mean, we do have some volunteers who really need extra help because they're seeing it up close, or when they're delivering items, the trauma that people are going through is being shared with them, and it can be overwhelming.
That was Navajo attorney Ethel Branch, the founder of the Navajo and Hopi Families COVID-19 Relief Fund in Flagstaff, Arizona. She was speaking to VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and good night.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
As a sign of the U.S. government's ongoing commitment to combating human trafficking, the State Department released its 20th Annual Trafficking in Persons Report, or TIP Report, on June 25th. Speaking at the release of the TIP Report, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo noted that human trafficking, which includes both forced labor and sex trafficking, continues around the world.
There are 25 million adults and children suffering from labor and sex trafficking worldwide. That desecration of the inherent value and immeasurable worth of human beings, each of us created in the image of God, makes human trafficking a truly wicked act.
Last year, President Donald Trump restricted certain types of assistance to 15 governments that were ranked Tier 3, the worst possible designation in the 2019 TIP report. In January of this year, the president noted that the United States had authorized nearly $500 million to fight against sex and labor trafficking. Secretary Pompeo highlighted several success stories recorded in the 2020 TIP report.
22 countries received upgrade this year, 13 of them from sub-Saharan Africa.
The TIP report also calls out a group of nations whose state-sponsored forced labor have earned them Tier 3 designations. Among them is China, where the Chinese Communist Party and its state-owned enterprises often force citizens to work in horrendous conditions on China's global development strategy known as Belt and Road, and where Uyghurs and other Muslim minorities are subjected to widespread forced labor in Xinjiang and beyond. In Cuba, the Castro regime's number one source of income is the medical mission program. There are up to 50,000 Cuban medical professionals serving in 60 countries around the world. Several of these doctors have defected and reported being coerced and forced to work in these programs. Many countries allow the medical mission to operate despite clear indicators of human trafficking, such as passport confiscation, hidden contracts, and direct payments to the regime and not the doctors. "We take government-sponsored trafficking very seriously," declared Secretary Pompeo. "It's a perversion of any government's reason for existence, to protect rights, not crush them. The United States will not stand by as any government with a policy or pattern of human trafficking subjects its own citizens to this kind of oppression."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.